evening. At this time, we begin the segment on LIMOC. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. Tonight, we'll be covering what took place at the Hamvention, the flea market, call it what you like, and other subjects. The way a person signs in, if you've got a question or a comment for the net, is to give me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like K2KEY, no, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. WC2C, yes. And did you say your name was Aaron?
Yes, this is WC2C, Aaron, yes.
Sorry for an Aaron. You're on the list. Anyone else checking? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WS2N, Paul. No, but good evening, Dick.
You should have a question. You just wait and see what these guys are going to be asking tonight, Paul. And we're looking forward to hearing from Paul because the space shuttle was launched. Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2MWA, yes.
Steve, and yes.
Okay, we got KC2MWA, and we also got Steve. Steve, give me your call letters.
KC2MDP.
Mike Delta Papa, Steve. All right. And MWA, I think I've got your name, MWA. Please tell me again.
It's Bob, Dick. I didn't see you at the Hamfest, but I know you were there.
Yes, I know. And I didn't see Mel, and I haven't heard from Mel yet. I'm getting a little worried. Mel, are you there? Not a good sign. Okay, anyone else to check in? One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Aaron, you're number one on the runway. We don't have a great big list tonight, so you can take your own sweet time. You can ask us lots of questions. You may or may not get lots of answers, but the price is right. WC2C, formerly of New York City, teaching K2LIW.
Very good. K2LIW, the group, this is WC2C. Very nice seeing you earlier today. I just want to report to you on the question that I asked you about the person's radio shutting off when they keyed up on 40 meters. Well, we put up six of those snap-on chokes on the DC leads of the radio, and the ailments went away completely. Absolutely no problem whatsoever. So I just want to report to you on that. And once again, it was very nice seeing you earlier today. This is WC2C.
That's quite a success story, Aaron. Amazing. I'm amazed you guys got a cure that easily, that fast. Yes, these ferrites, when you put them on a power cord or on the B-plus cord, whichever, they do some real magic. Let me explain that one. You can start off with a six-sided metallic box where all six sides and all of the joints are making good contact with each other. Properly constructed, that box is good for something like 110 decibels of shielding. However, you bring a power cord into the box. The power cord has got an external length of wire, the length of which is significant. It's picking up signals. It's acting like an antenna. The wire goes to the wall of the box and brings that nasty RF energy inside the box where it can do all kinds of mischief with your electronics. Bypassing the wire as it enters the box by way of a filter con, which is a series of capacitors with very low inductance to ground of the shield of the box. That does a lot of good work. And in the case of putting on ferrite beads, or these clip-on things, they enhance the magnetic field. Let me explain that. In order for any real power to go down the power cord and into the box, current must flow on the wire. Whenever current flows on the wire, picture grabbing a piece of wire with your right hand, and your thumb is in the direction that the current is flowing. Your fingers curled around the wire are where the magnetic field wants to flow because of the current that's flowing in the wire. X number of amperes of current makes X number of gauss of magnetic field. When you put a toroid-shaped object over the wire, you've now provided a path for that magnetic field to curl around the wire. The ferrite material has a lot lower magnetic resistance. It's really called reluctance, but you know what I mean. The magnetic field can flow through the ferrite material a lot more easily than it can flow through air. Therefore, you're building up magnetic field a lot faster than you ordinarily would, and therefore, the wire going through the ferrite develops a kind of a voltage drop due to the magnetic field. So it cuts down the amount of voltage of the RF, or the amount of current, you can look at it either way, that enters the box. So you put enough of those ferrites on your piece of coax cable, you're really building a balun. The W2AU balun, I think, works like that. And so, how many of those chunks did you put on there? How long was each one, Aaron? Where did you buy them? How much did they cost? And that's an amazing success story. I would have given you guys a 50-50 chance of that alone doing the trick. WC2C, K2RIW in the tech net.
And this is WC2C. Well, we got six of them. They're about an inch long. Inch, I'd say, diameter, you know. And about an inch long in length. We got six of them, put six in a row. And over the power lead, and it worked out very well. We got them at the Hamfest from the guy who sells all that power stuff and antennas. You know, the guy with the beard. I forgot his name.
And when you said the power lead, I presume you mean the 110-volt power cord, not the 12-volt output lead of the power supply?
I put them across the red and black wires that go to the power supply because it's connected to an Astron RS-35M. And where it's connected to that, it goes into the radio, and it's over that wire that the toroids were put.
Now, did you put the toroids on each individual wire, some of them on the red and some on the black, or did you run the reds and the blacks together through each individual toroid? I'm going to guess you did the second. Is that true, Aaron?
That's true, because the red and black wire kind of married together. They're joined together. There's one spot... Where there are fuses, so that's, in that spot, the wires are separate. But for the length of the wire, basically the two wires are joined together at a seam.
Well done. I expected that you guys were going to get some improvement from the ferrite, and that you would also have to put bypass capacitors where the wires enter the power supply or into the rig that's being offended, or both. And you obviously didn't have to put on the disc ceramic capacitors. The ferrites were enough. Well done. You're lucky. It shouldn't be that easy. Okay. Now, the rig itself that's creating the grief, how far away is the antenna, and what kind of an antenna was it, Alan? Go ahead.
Hey, it's an ICOM 746, and the antenna is a G5RV in the trees. I'd say it's about... 30-35 feet away, and the coax is, you know, RG213, you know, the thicker type of coax, and that's it. The radio loads up at all bands now. It loaded up before nicely also, except on 40 meters. When he pushed the tune button to tune it automatically, everything would go dead. I mean, the radio would blank out, the power supply would go crazy, would turn off. And in order to get the radio on again, you had to shut off the power supply and turn it back on. Even during the tune cycle, which maybe even puts out only 10 watts.
Impressive. Now, I am guessing what happened here, Aaron, is that a well-made power supply, and maybe your RS-35M is one of these, that has an overvoltage protect circuit. Most voltage regulating power supplies, when they're trying to put out, let's say, 13.5 volts, they're really generating something like 25 volts internally. And the pass transistor is cutting the 25 volts down to 13.5 and doing it with nice feedback to get rid of the ripple and the hum and and everything else and the noise. But if anything goes wrong with that regulator, in theory, a full 35 or 25 volts can come rolling out of the supply, and that going into the IC-746 could very well give it some grief. So a well-made power supply has a built-in over-voltage protect circuit, and depending where the trip point is, the trip point could have been set at, say, 17 volts or 18 volts, typical numbers. In other words, a 13.5 volt rig will tolerate 17 volts for a short period of time without doing damage. You exceed that, and damage could occur. The over-voltage protection circuit, when it gets tripped, creates a dead short. The dead short is sensed by the power supply, and it goes into some kind of a turn-off protect mode or whatever. So I am guessing the RF energy coming down the outside of the RG213 from the G5RV antenna, some of it was getting onto the power supply and false alarming that overvoltage protect circuit. It's called a crowbar circuit in some cases. That's a guess. And there's various versions of the G5RV. Some of the G5RVs, if you follow Lou Varney's original article, you have a piece of coax cable for a certain length, you have a piece of twin lead, a transmission line for a certain length, and then the real G5RV antenna. A number of people have discovered that the antenna works almost as well without the twin lead. However, the twin lead, I think, at least on some bands, and maybe 40 meters is one of the bands, the twin lead is acting like a balloning device, which limits the amount of current flowing down the outside of the cable. I am going to guess that in a particular installation under discussion, the twin lead maybe wasn't there, maybe that was an aggravating factor, and maybe not. Maybe just the way the G5RV is laid on the top of the house, just having to couple into the house wiring, and aggravating the problem. There's a lot of variables involved. So do you think that G5RV has the twin lead in it, Aaron? Have you seen you too? If you are, then you can check that.
But really not that high up. It's kind of like parallel to the house. I don't know, the antenna may be at most 20 feet up in the air. That's about it. You know, so it's not really that high. You know, that's very well possible. But I'm just glad the problem got solved. Certainly, you know, no one needs aggravation when you want to get on the air and talk to your friends. I live in Brooklyn. I don't use that kind of antenna. I use just a fan dipole with elements for 15, 20, and 40 meters. And I could also load up on 18 megahertz, 10 megahertz, all kinds of megahertz with the built-in antenna tuner on the Kenwood TS-440, which I have. But I also had RF in the shack at one point, an RF through the microphone. Now, this RF gets around. And I also put on toroids. I bought these MFJ things, and I wrapped a little coax on it. I also wrapped the mic cord through this MFJ snap-on chokes, and it solved my problem. Over.
Fantastic. The RF chokes, the six of them, the half dozen you guys bought today, roughly what was the price of those, Aaron?
$3 a piece, which is like, when you think about it, less than $20, you solve the whole problem. It's like tremendous.
Well done. Okay. That's a success story. How about that? Okay. I would have given you guys only a 50-50 chance that just that alone was going to do it. And from my point of view, you were a little bit lucky. Let's see what Bob's got to say. And Bob, I've talked to you so darn often. Why didn't I not recognize your call letters? You know, these guys over 40, they start getting old-timers disease. KC2MWA, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Bob.
Clay check in N2EO, yes.
N2EO is in on the list. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Dick, KC2MWA. This gets to be, I don't know, maybe an oddball question. If you were down here today, you might have spotted the big, long 2-meter beam I have sitting on the top of my van. It's got a 20-foot boom. I'm going to try and shorten it down to a 10-foot boom. I set it up in the yard today that way after I got back from the ham fest, and I put the antenna analyzer on it, and I'm finding that it's really not in the 2 meter band. It's a great antenna if you want to operate on 138 megahertz. The antenna is designed in such a way that you have one reflector, four driven elements arranged in a log periodic design, and several directors in front of it. When I get done with it, the way I think I'm going to have it, it's going to be about seven, counting the four driven elements as one element, it'll be about a seven element beam with a 10-foot boom. I'm just curious, how am I going to get this thing tuned into the band? Obviously, I've got to lengthen the driven element, but I was trying to figure out what was the logical sequence in which to do that. Over.
Interesting. I wish I had known that was you, Bob. I saw the antenna on top of the van. I said, that is a beautiful-looking 2-meter Yagi, nice-long Yagi. I was about to make an offer to the person who had it there. I assume it was there because it was being sold. As I walked toward the front of your van, away from the aisle you were parked, I saw the back end of the antenna. I immediately recognized it as the KLM log periodic, or Swan Yagi, as it used to be called in the old days, with the four driven elements with the crisscross rods between it. That stopped me right there. That was the instant in which I decided I'm not going to make that person an offer. Not because it's a bad antenna, because it's a troublesome antenna. Mike Stahl, K6MYC, had a series of articles way back in the dark ages of, oh, I'm going to make a guess now, 1968, Ham Radio Magazine. The philosophy in those days was that if you start off with a log periodic Yagi, which is known to be broadband, so if you start off with a log periodic cell, as he called it, which launches the signal and then the directors take over, you expect to have the gain of a log Yagi with the bandwidth of a log periodic. That was the philosophy. Good sounding philosophy. Mike Stahl was here when he did that. He was on the veranda of his house in Morgan Hills, California, where he designed that antenna. That if one single one of those eight rods, or if one single one of those crisscross intermediate aluminum bars that are all in contact pressure with each other with 632 screws, if one of them makes a contact that is, let me pick a number, 50 milliohms, you're going to see a significant change in the way the antenna tunes, its swept bandwidth, its VISWA, its gain, its performance will all change. So you've got a beautiful looking antenna, and in my opinion, the only critical area is those four driven elements on the log periodic cell. I recommend you try just a quick experiment with your ohm meter, and even if your ohm meter says everything's hunky-dory, that is a necessary but not sufficient. If your ohm meter tells you that one of those eight rods or one of those crisscross pieces of aluminum is not making what looks like zero ohms on your ohm meter, if one of them is not doing that, right away you found something that's significant. But even if you pass the ohm meter test, the next test is the four-leaded ohm meter test, a so-called Kelvin ohm meter test. And on the next transmission, if you need, we'll go into that description. So that's part of what I think might be going on there, Bob. KC2MWA, K2LIW on the tech net.
Okay, KC2MWA. Jack, I think when you're talking about a Kelvin ohm meter, you're talking about one with a guard circuit on it to rule out any, shall we say, thermocouple effect where the metals are coupling together?
Good guess, but no. If I'm trying to measure the ohms, let me double check now. Backtrack. Let's assume I've got two aluminum strips in front of me, and I overlap one over the other with a screw hole through them, and I put a 632 screw through the hole and tighten it. If you're making real good contact between the two sheets of aluminum because they're nice and new and shiny, and you just steel wool them, I said steel wool, you just Scotch-Brite them. You don't want to use steel wool. You use steel wool on aluminum. The interface of the steel and the aluminum makes a brand new nasty compound. Scotch-Brite is a ceramic-like material. It's sort of purple in color, and it will do what steel wool does, but it doesn't create these nasty compounds that steel wool does when it's rubbing on aluminum. So you Scotch-Brite your two sheets of aluminum, you overlap them, you put the screw through it, and you tighten it down, and you try to measure whether or not you're getting good contact. Good contact between the two aluminum strips. Doesn't matter. The constant current generator is producing the voltage drop, and now you're measuring the real number of ohms of that junction. That technique is called the four-leaded ohm meter. Some people call it the Kelvin connection type ohm meter. I'm sure it's got a number of other contacts. But when you're trying to resolve milliohms, that's essentially the only way to do it. You would like to have milliohms on every one of those eight rods and every one of those eight aluminum strips on that antenna. If not, it will tune itself to another frequency, it'll have another pattern, it'll have another chunk of gain, it'll have another bandwidth, it'll have some fizzwar. And I'm guessing there's a 50-50 chance or higher this could be what you're running into, Bob. KC2 MWA, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, KC2 MWA. Gives me something simple and easy to do. I do have the antioxidation compound here. So I'll go get my chunk of Scotch-Brite next weekend and start polishing aluminum and putting this stuff on, and then I'll check it and see what kind of continuity I have. I have a rather good digital voltmeter that I use for work. I think that will give me enough significant decimal bases that I'll get some sort of an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, most guys nowadays own a DVM, a digital voltmeter. It can, on the most sensitive scale, probably give you more than what you want. If you can go down to 0.01 volts, you've got it. That's equal to 10 milliohms with a 1 ampere. And by the way, you can make the whole system more sensitive. Instead of pulling 1 ampere through the aluminum, pull 2 amperes. Now each millivolt represents 2 milliohms. I got it backwards. Each 2 millivolts represents 1 milliohm if you put 2 amperes. Now, the Bob I know, the KC2 MWA, is a little bit of a scientist. Therefore, he's going to make the measurement first on the virgin antenna before he takes it apart, before he shines it up with Scotch-Brite, and before he does weather protecting or whatever. It would be very nice to know that before you disturb the antenna, that one of those rods or three of those rods were making a half-ohm contact, one of them was making a 50-ohm contact, and one of them was an open circuit. That's damn interesting information. So I do recommend, since you're ultimately going to be checking it with your 4-leaded ohm meter setup, that just use the 4-leaded ohm meter setup first and find out what you got. And that would give you a hell of a lot more time to find out that one of those rods or one of those circuits was not making a 50 contact. And by the way, we're giving you a homework assignment, Robert. We've got a great story to share with you. We're all going to be hanging on the table and share Sunday to tell us what kind of home measure on those eight rods. If you do it today, if you are looking for that.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to be a light quality bird. That's what you now have.
I'm not sure. It didn't have two flavors, based on errors. However, automatic cell is working correctly. Really, Johnson's got enough to put up the whole system. You have to leave wind cell, which might require you to put a full system over the system. It might require a necessary sort of a vertical plane, and you can move back behind the reflector. It'll have no performance change on the electrical performance of the antenna, but now it will be wind balanced, so even if it's wrong, it will not be stretching your rotator. And once you have the ability to mount that on the chimney of your house, although it may be a big antenna, it's not considered a foot or a comparable size. So I'm wondering why you feel you must shorten the antenna. Yes, you take a long yagi of the structure DL50W2. He is Mr. Yagi on planet Earth. And so, take one of the Gunter Hutt's design Yagi, and maybe you chose his 21 element Yagi, and you cut it down to 15 or 13 or 9 elements, and those designs are extremely forgiving. And by the way, a Gunter Hutt Yagi on 432 will give you and me an acceptable visual from about 422 to about 445 megacycles. The Don antenna is about 20 megacycles wide, and it's an ordinary Yagi with an ordinary driven element when your eye looks at the antenna. There's a lot more going on there. The left periodic cell, which was designed to be brought there, is not 20 megacycles wide, it's 2 megacycles wide, not 432. You can see what happened here. We're starting to surprise you, so to speak, from my soul on the solar cell. But you're sort of right, even with the DOM antenna, the one you've got in your hand, you eliminate a few of the directors out front, it's going to have a minor difference on the visual. I don't think your back is against the wall, Bob, where you're forced into a smaller antenna in order to give it physical survival. So tell me what's going on there, and see if I can talk you out of eliminating those elements and leave that part alone. KC2MWA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, KC2MWA. The problem is space. I haven't got enough room where I was going to put this beam up to get it to swing with that boom length and not hit something. That's why I was going to try and shorten it down to 10 feet in total length instead of the 20 feet, see if I could get it to perform reasonably well and put that up, because that I could handle.
W2VL.
Okay, well, you say you don't have enough space, Bob. Does that mean there's a tree in the way? And is it the wife's favorite magnolia tree, and you can't possibly cut away that branch? Is that what's happening, Bob?
Go ahead. Okay, KC2MWA. Dick, it's not only a tree, it's other antennas and other structures on the roof. That's where the limit's coming in. I had considered that if I had sold this today, I would go out and buy like a 3 or 4 element, a 2 meter Yagi and put that up. It would meet my needs. I don't really need something as big as what I've got right now.
Okay. Even though you've got other antennas on other structures on the roof, I still think there's ways of raising one, lower the other, so that they miss each other when they turn. And you'd be amazed how close the antennas can come to each other as long as they are on different bands before they interfere with each other. So you've got a number of options. But once again, I'm going to be extremely curious as to what you find when you do the 4-leaded ohm meter test. Start off with a regular ohm meter first. That'll allow you to find a complete open circuit. And maybe wiggle them a little bit to make sure that they're continuing to make good contact. But the 4-leaded ohm meter test is really going to tell you what's happening. And I think what I would do is, as I remember, the back end of the antenna, the crisscross aluminum rods, aluminum sheets, they have a turnaround that's a U-shaped thing. I think I would... Nope, can't do that. Yes. I think I would connect one lead of my constant current power supply and one lead of my ohm meter right in the middle of that U-shape. Then as I go down the antenna from that point forward, measuring each element, I'm automatically measuring not only whether the eight rods are making contact, but I'm simultaneously checking the integrity of every one of the crisscross pieces of aluminum. And if I can get to the most forward element, eight rods downrange, on the left side and the right side, four to the left side, four on the right side, and still measure a small number of milliohms, then that antenna is really flying, and K2LIW has led you on a false alarm of chasing a wild goose. I'm relatively sure when you do that test, I give you an 80% chance you're going to find something you're unhappy with those ohmic contacts. Because unless that antenna was carefully shined up with Scotch-Brite a small number of years ago and kept in a pristine, dry environment where no aluminum oxide fell happened, and that's essentially impossible. You'd have to put it in a dry nitrogen atmosphere. I guarantee nobody did that. So I think there's a relatively high chance that aluminum oxide was built up, contacts were broken, and that's some of what you're saying. And okay, if you're sure that you can't get rid of all those, if you can't find a way of turning this antenna in such a way that it goes in between the other antennas and misses them, then I guess you've got to shorten it. When you do shorten it, don't throw away those pieces that do the shortening. Hang on to them, because I think you're going to want to use them downrange. Back to you, Bob, for any further comments on this very good-looking antenna of yours. KC2MWA, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, KC2MWA. Well, the only last comment I'll make here this evening is you should have seen what it looked like before I started working on it. It was very heavily oxidized in a pile of dirt in somebody's backyard on the ground. I had to replace missing elements. I had to make new supports for the directors and a few other odds and ends. So we'll see what happens with this. This is a project that I can take some time with. I still have to get up that 6-meter beam that I built, which is right now sitting on the test stand over the top of the 2-meter one. So maybe when I get it up free in space without too much other metal around it, the antenna will perform a little bit better. But it's just, distance seems to be working quite right. So we'll clean it all up, put the glop on it, and see what kind of results we get out of it. Thank God for antenna analyzers. Back to that. Pick up the next guy, please.
Very fine. Hey, you did the flight of the Phoenix here. You're doing a Phoenix experiment. If that antenna was in that bad a shape, buried in the dirt in somebody's backyard, man, you're resurrecting that thing from the dead. Well done. Enthusiastic project. But it's a good-looking antenna. You've done a nice job. Okay. I think the next person is Steve, KC2 Mike Delta Papa. We'll discuss anything except antennas tonight, Steve, and I'm kidding you. You got it, Steve.
And very good, Dick. Good evening to you. Good evening to everyone else on that. Basically, I have a follow-up to the last 2 weeks with my ICOM IC551, the problem with the sideband, and then I have a quick question. The follow-up is basically, thanks to Andy WA2CDL, we got it back on the air. He was generous enough to invite me over last Monday. He showed me his garage and all his goodies in there. And basically, he troubleshot it for me and found the problem. Turns out that there's a little trim pot that was in the PLL, and basically this thing had something to do with the tuning. And basically, you know, you say you put it to 50.125, and it would be on whatever frequency this thing went to when you shut it off and turned it on, and it wouldn't, you know, advance or retard the frequency until, let's say, you know, 50.350. So he found this little pot, fixed it, and I was also very impressed with this not antenna analyzer, service monitor he had, this Motorola service monitor. Boy, that thing was worth its weight in gold. And we got the problem solved, and I'd like to thank Andy. I don't think he's on tonight. He said he had a prior engagement tonight. And for my question, my antenna, I want to change the cable, and I want to use LMR Ultraflex. Now, I had used this stuff for my 1296 antenna, and basically the jack on this stuff is almost like a, you know, the SJ cord, a real rubbery outer jacket on it. And I had a bear of a time trying to get connectors on this thing. Is there any special way to put a connector on this, or do they actually make special connectors for this LMR Ultraflex? Back to you, Dick.
N2HYS. N2HYS. H-Y-S. And there is a website. Why don't I know right now the name of the company who is buying, selling, distributing, giving information, and whatever. But the LMR website, when you go to it, they will tell you the model number of the connector that fits it, that's designed for each one of those cables. The bad news, I'm guessing, is that those connectors might be a little bit pricey, but they do make a special connector for it. Mr. NYS, if you happen to, or HYS, if you happen to have that piece of information, please tell us. KTYIW.
And to HYR, actually, Jesse here. I wanted to throw in there, putting in the conducting anti-seize when putting back those antennas together after being polished up, and then they stay uncorroded and welding for years afterwards. And yes, there are special connectors for the LM, the Times Fiber cables.
Okay, that's right, Times Wire. And now it's coming back to me. Times Wire and Cable, when you go to their website and you look at each one of the LMR cables, and they got a zillion of them, various diameters and flexing, non-flexing, and high loss, low loss, whatever, they got quite a few of them. And there's a recommended connector for each one of them. Now, a smart amateur can usually take the connector that's in his hand and modify it somehow to make it work. Once he has sufficient understanding of the way the RF works, he might have to do a little bit of lathe work, a little bit of filing on the nut on the connector to make it big enough to fit over the rubber of the cable. He might have to sand down the center conductor a little bit so it'll solder into the real pin of the connector and so on. We've all done these various modifications. And unless you're working at 1296, you can get away with murder, because the connector in general is only an inch long. If you were operating at 432, the wavelength of 432 is 27 inches. Therefore, the whole darn connector is only 1/27 of a wavelength long. What is it? About 10 degrees electrical in length. So therefore, the internal dimensions of the connector, instead of being perfect 50 ohms, could be 31.5 ohms or 91 ohms, and it wouldn't matter because it's such a short length. So within reason, you can get away with murder with what you do within the connector. What you do inside the connector, your major motivation is mechanical. You're making things fit. You're making things strong. You're making things weatherproof. So once you understand what your real motivation is, whether the connector is a constant impedance, like a type N properly installed, a UG21, or whether it be a UHF connector, which really is a 35 ohm internal impedance, 432 and below, it doesn't matter. So with that in mind, there's a lot of things you can do to force the connector in your hand to do the job. But if you want to do it double darn good, then you go out and read the website on Times Wire and Cable on the LMR section, and you find out the exact connector and you go and order it. You got a bunch of choices there, as I see it, Steve. And congratulations on your IC551 back in health. I bet it sounds pretty good. And those service monitors, yeah, I've used them. And they are wonderful piece of machinery. A real good service monitor. You can be testing a repeater with the darn thing if it's got the right options. You're pulling 75 watts of power out of the repeater into the service monitor. At the exact same time, the service monitor, 600 KC away, is generating a signal that is a quarter of a microvolt, and you're measuring the squelch sensitivity of your repeater. A machine that does all that in one box and gives you a spectrum analyzer display at the same time as what is the spectral purity of your transmitter. And you can also simultaneously be measuring whether or not the PL tone has got the right center frequency and the right amount of deviation. That's the box. KC2MDP, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, this thing was very, very impressive. He showed me this thing, and I was like, wow, I got to get me one of those, by hook or by crook, I got to get one of those. And I just out of curiosity, I looked on eBay for, they got some there for $1,200. They had one there that, I forget, it was like 24 grand, I think. I almost fell over on that. But yeah, it actually took Andy probably about 5 minutes to find the initial problem with that service monitor. I was really impressed. Back to you.
Okay, now back to your connector on the LMR. I wonder if I've convinced you that within reason, a good crafty ham can take the wrong connector on the wrong cable and with hose clamps and pieces of copper and lathe work and file and whatever, you can make the connector work, and your motivation is mechanical and weatherproofing. Don't worry about constant impedance. As long as you don't have some of the whiskers of the blade shorting out between semiconductor and shield, and as long as you don't have a complete open circuit on the soldering of the pin that goes on the semiconductor, as long as you don't do something really gross like that, you can get away with murder. Back to you, Steve, if you want any further comment on the connectors that you've got and whether or not you can force it to work.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I was just wondering if I was initially doing something wrong here, trying to get this connector wrong, or if they actually did make something. You know, when I did the 1296, it was an N connector, but it had the threads on it, like, you know, the old PL259s, you know, you like thread it onto the outer jacket and then solder the outer braid, and of course, you know, you solder the inner pin. What I ended up doing with this stuff is, you know, you try and thread it on, and this stuff is so rubbery, it would just sort of push back on you. What I ended up doing is taking the ends of it and actually sticking it in the freezer and let it sit in there for like 15, 20 minutes to make that outer jacket hard enough where I could actually thread the end of the connector on, and that seemed to work. I mean, it sounds a little ridiculous, but it actually worked. Back to you.
Okay, with a comment. Okay, JJ recognized. Now, that's very crafty. You'd be amazed how many times in industry people will use a freezer to change the mechanical characteristics for the time that they're doing it. The great big huge joint that's the wing pivot for a 750,000-pound airplane called B-1B Bomber. It's a great big titanium pin that I guess is around 2 feet in diameter. They freeze it with liquid nitrogen to make it small. They shove it into the hole, and then they let it warm up and expands and makes the tightest joint you ever saw. And when it comes to taking that thing back out, they got to go through a real elaborate process. But even in industry, they will use freezing and heating and whatever to mechanically change things to temporarily give them the property they want in order to accomplish the installation process. Doug, what are the guys in Yonkers have got to say tonight? KQJJ, KQIW, and the Tech Man.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and hello to all aboard. Yeah, on the LMR connectors, Dick, yeah, you can kludge around and make them up if you need to. It gets a little bit of a challenge when you get into the N connector variety, but I have done it with PL259s, but the time involved, I found it just easier to buy buy the proper connectors, Dick. They're between $10 and $20, let's say, depending on the size of the cable. And you can get those from cable experts. So just depends how much time you have, but I found it a bit easier, particularly with end connectors, to buy the proper connector, I think.
The end connectors are also interesting on that cable.
Okay, see. Now, when it comes to putting connectors on the end of the cable, my philosophy seems to differ with an awful lot of people, but still I'm going to stick with my philosophy, and here it is.